Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
What's up, everybody? The Cinema Specialists are back, and we are here with an episode that I have been dying to talk about. I am so excited for this one. If anybody listened to our top 100 movies of all time, John and I did that podcast over the course of 2 years back, right after COVID ended. I think we started at the beginning of 2021, and we worked our way through our favorite 100 movies. I had the original Planet of the Apes way up there, I think at 20 or 21, something along those lines. Still to this day, one of my all-time favorite movies. And then when they released this prequel trilogy, I was so concerned. The Tim Burton movie is a travesty. It's such a piece of shit. And when they released this prequel trilogy, I just said to myself, they better be good. And Rise of the Planet of the Apes was awesome. It had a great story. It's a really fun movie. And then they released Dawn. And oh my God, does Dawn just do everything so well? We're going to talk about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. We're also going to be talking about Westworld tonight. And I think Westworld is going to be such a fun discussion. The 1973 movie that the show was based on loosely. So if you have never seen Westworld, it's a movie you should definitely check out. We're going to be breaking that down. Kind of the theme of the night is gaining consciousness, huh? That is really what it's all about. What makes someone human, and how does... what happens when people or beings or robots that aren't supposed to have human consciousness start to get it? Jordan offered in the comments saying, hello, guys. Hello to everybody who's here. Hello to John. Like this video, subscribe to the channel if you are not. And make sure you like the video, because that helps, goes a long way, especially with these movie podcasts. We're trying to build them up and get more people watching, more people listening. If you're listening over on iTunes, Spotify, any of that fun stuff, head on over to the YouTube every now and then and give us a like. But John, welcome. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and Westworld Night. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes releases Thursday. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. Revisiting these Planet of the Apes movies was really fun this week. This trilogy is one that surprised me with how well it was executed. And I've never seen Westworld before this week.
Really?
So, yeah, I've never seen the original Westworld. I watched, I think, the first three seasons of the show. But I never went and watched the original film. And it was, it's a very, very interesting 70s sci-fi film.
John, I'm going to make you come out, go out and come back in, because you sound a little bit fuzzier than you normally sound. So I don't know if it's a headphone thing or what. That came through. I understood everything you said, but it was just a little weird. So go out, come back in. John will be back in just one quick second. But yes, Westworld is a movie that when I was younger. Oh, John is trying to figure it out without even looking. He's trying to figure it out without leaving. I like his mentality here.
My microphone didn't turn on. That was the issue. Was.
Dude, I was going to say, I was like, what is going on? I didn't know that. You sound crystal clear now. Perfect. You're back. All right. Westworld was a movie when I was a kid. This is a movie that like my dad showed me when I was really young. You know, I was into Westerns. I loved The Magnificent Seven when I was a kid. I liked a lot of John Wayne movies. So Westworld was one that he said, oh, you got to check this out. And I remember watching this as a kid and thinking it was like the coolest thing ever. And you have to remember that this is coming right on the heels of Walt Disney World opening. And this movie came out in 1973. Walt Disney World opens in 1971. You have Disneyland, which now at this point had been around for, you know, 15 years, whatever it is, 16 years. And so when you put this movie out there, this is that take on what happens if things start to go really wrong. And I actually think this movie holds up really, really well, despite some of the cheesiness of it, because it was such an original movie 51 years ago when it came out, and it does ask some pretty heavy questions, and I think these two movies actually pair incredibly well together.
Yeah, Westworld was really interesting revisit. Like,
seeing it for the first time now, having already watched the series and everything, it's a fun movie. And I think you have to go into it knowing it's a fun movie, because and the concept of Westworld and where it's going is phenomenal. But I felt the film itself kind of lacked a bit of execution.
You know what's funny about Westworld, and we're gonna, this one will probably bounce a little bit more in between the movies than we normally do. I know it's some of the episodes on this new series with you haven't seen that. We have been bouncing back and forth between the movies a little more frequently. And then last week, we pretty much did a half hour. I don't think that's going to be the case this week, just because of how these movies do parallel one another. I think the thing with Westworld is, when I watched it as a kid, obviously you're not really worried about the story. You just like the idea. Mm-hmm. And then I remember watching it a couple of years ago. So actually one of my professors from college was the producer on this movie, Paul Lazarus. So he was actually one of my professors, and he's the reason why I know all the Best Picture winners, because I had to do a project and write a 15-page paper on Best Picture winners for his class. So that's why I know all the Best Picture winners so easily, and why I ended up seeking them all out, wanting to watch them and do all that fun stuff. But all that is, he produced this movie. So we had done a trip to LA. He was the person who took us out there. And so we watched the movie, and I remember being like, yeah, it's a good movie. Good. Enjoyed it. But it didn't live up to like the childlike hype. Right. And I actually appreciated it so much more this time on this viewing, because I feel like this movie really does do a great job of capturing that like overly optimistic view that a lot of humans have. I think Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, you know, when you talk about Rise of the Planet of the Apes, it's getting into the overly optimistic. They're trying to create the Alzheimer's drug. Look, it's working. Look what we can do. And I think Westworld was that, right? Of how real is real? How far can we push this so that we can give people the authentic experience that they are craving? Mm-hmm. And what happens when we push it too far? And this comes out in 1973, and it's written and directed by Michael Crichton, of all people. And Michael Crichton, obviously best known for writing the Jurassic Park novel. That book wasn't written until 1990. Mm-hmm. So you can really see where Michael Crichton was always thinking about this kind of thing throughout his entire career, of what happens when you make something too realistic, or when you go and do something that humans shouldn't necessarily do, all with the idea of creating entertainment and creating authentic experiences. I really appreciated kind of watching that through that view. And I watched season one of Westworld and loved it. I watched season two of Westworld and thought it was an absolute piece of shit. And I kind of like the simplicity of Westworld. I like the simplicity of the movie and how it just allows itself to get you caught up in the world itself.
And I think that is what the film does the best, is just the world building. It spends enough time with the characters we're following in the movie to really establish, you know, everything we need to know about the people who are going to Westworld. We find out how much it costs to go to Westworld. We find out, you know, Westworld isn't the only theme park in this area. There's the medieval world and there's Roman world. And unfortunately, we don't see a lot of Roman world. That one sounded quite exciting. But it's intercut with the behind the scenes of Westworld, which really helps build up this world and this experience and this idea of, this is still humans operating everything. Mm-hmm. And then it introduces that idea of this virus, essentially, that's going on with the robots, which is turning them violent. Mm-hmm. And like, that's kind of where it loses me a little bit, in all honesty. There's just no explanation for it ever. And that's fine. You don't need an explanation for everything. But I feel like this movie just doesn't go quite that next step. And it's really awkward talking about this movie in a post-HBO's Westworld, where they do realize the potential overly of it, and they do overly explain it, but they also get there, right? That first season of Westworld is so fantastic because it's exploring those moral quandaries and everything of these now sentient beings realizing their sentience. And we don't get that in this movie. Instead, we kind of just have Yul Brynner being a Terminator-esque character. Like,
Whoa. The Terminator is a Yul Brynner-esque character. You gotta get that right.
Yes, technically, yeah, that is true.
Get your orders correct here, sir.
I understand the order of it, but the point of it is that I'm saying is, like, he's just kind of this stalking villain. Mm-hmm. That follows around, and we don't get, and unfortunately, we don't get any depth in character to any of the robots at all. They're just machines.
I don't think we need a depth to character in the robots, because I think if you go depth to character in the robots, like, you're starting to go down a different path than what this movie was trying to be. I think what this movie was missing was more of what you're talking about, the explanations of why things are starting to go wrong. We get a lot of, oh, it happened again. This is so weird. It happened again. We got to go do the updates. And, oh, I'm going to put in the new eyes. And we see how the eyes, there's something going on with the eyes. But it would have been nice. I don't need the over explanation of the science behind it all. But you see in Jurassic Park with the embryos and all of that, they do a really good job of establishing it. And you can see how much Michael Crichton learned from this experience of making this movie. I also think, though, 1973, you're talking, this is a pre-Star Wars world. Like, we are not at Star Wars yet, and they're making this kind of science fiction movie where you're going into this other world. I think yes, does Westworld have some flaws? Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. But I think the concept of Westworld is absolutely phenomenal, and I think that it actually does stand the test of time better than it has any reason to, considering how many of these types of movies we've seen change or come out over time. You know, then they obviously make the second movie Future World, which is essentially just Westworld made again, and Yul Brynner's back, don't worry. But for me, what always gets me with this movie is at the end when he goes into Roman world or medieval world, whatever the hell it is, and he gets the I'm gonna save you, and he saves the girl, and it ends up being a robot. And it's at that point that you realize he can't even tell them apart. And that's what they're saying throughout the entire movie. Well, the point is, you can't tell them apart. That's what's exciting about it. That's what's fun. Why do you care? It doesn't matter. Look at the hands. That's what you'll notice. And it is that idea of, you know, what makes us human. On our Patreon podcast, we actually line this up insanely well. On our Patreon podcast that's coming out next Tuesday, we're doing Being John Malkovich. And that's another movie that is all about, like, what does it mean to be human? What makes you human? What makes you a conscious being? And all of that. And when we start to talk about Planet of the Apes, which at this point, clearly we're saving Planet of the Apes as much as we can for the back half of this, because it is the exciting one. It is the big one. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes releases in 2 days. But to see how these three very different movies handle this subject matter is really fascinating. And Westworld probably spends a little too much time building the Westworld world, considering it's only 88 minutes long. And it probably a little too little time actually diving into the behind the scenes of the Westworld world. Because I think more time spent with the behind the scenes of Westworld could have really made this into an all-time, absolute, no questions asked classic.
We kind of need a, like, and it's kind of a, now, right, we're talking about the Michael Crichton of it all. It's kind of impossible not to make the Jurassic Park analogs. We kind of need like a J.D. Wong in this movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, we just need that scientist who's explaining things just a little bit. We need to see, it really needed kind of a dual plot where we have maybe an investor or something in the back, like, getting the background to everything, and then we have the guests and we're seeing what the guests are experiencing, or even someone like trying to figure out what this sickness is that's going throughout the robots and causing them to change. Do I need an origin for the virus? No, but I need some urgency involving it.
Yeah, and I will say, like, the opening of this movie, when they do the fake infomercial thing, the commercial about, oh, you got to go to Westworld. Oh, I was just there. I was sheriff for 2 weeks and all that. I thought that was awesome. It's so tongue-in-cheek. It's so well done. I love the way they're selling that. But I do agree with you that Delos is too far removed from this movie. What is, because Delos is this great name. It has this great subject matter. It looks really cool. Like, what is Delos? You feel like the way they put that front and center on you at the beginning of this movie, that Delos is going to be something huge.
Yeah.
And it really never plays out. Delos is never really a thing. We really are seeing this movie mostly through the eyes of our protagonist and his buddy. And we got the James Brolin, who's, you know, been to this place, you know, so many times, doesn't even to listen anymore. And we get the other guy who's brand new and just excited that he's going to be in this world and he's starting to live through it. But there could have been a third storyline, and they start to do it with, you know, the scientists and all of that, but they could have done a little bit more with it and probably made it feel a little more satisfying. But I still can't, I can't help but kind of marvel at the idea of the Yul Brynner gunslinger character is essentially so tired of being killed and rebooted and whatever. And he's programmed just to kill, right? Like, he's programmed to be violent. He's programmed to do whatever. And now he's almost programmed to get revenge at this point. He doesn't know anything else except kill, kill, kill. These people are coming at me. I must kill them. And it's almost like he develops a memory. And we do see that in the show Westworld, where they really dive into the memories and the understanding of these robots. And that was something that this movie definitely could have done a little bit more of. But again, pre-Star Wars world 1973, I just don't think that they were thinking of that. I just don't think that's where their heads could be.
I agree. And this movie feels almost more like a horror movie than a science fiction movie at times, just in the presentation of it. The scene, like the first night we spend in Westworld and we just see the staff pulling all the dead bodies out of the streets is haunting. It is a haunting scene that really kind of shows the length that Delos is going to keep this illusion of the world going. And it does show the commitment to making sure that this park is operating correctly. But when we get to those last like 15 minutes of this movie just lost me completely. And it's great, like, seeing Yul Brynner be this terrifying, imposing figure. But it's just chasing through all of these different set pieces that they probably should have showed us in the rest of the movie.
Yeah, what did you think about the bouncing back and forth between the two, or the three different worlds? Because they give you pretty much one character in each of the worlds. Mm-hmm. Roman world definitely gets the least, but they pretty much give you one character in each of the worlds where you're seeing their story and you're kind of seeing bad things happen to them first. What did you think of that?
Again, I don't think we spend enough time with these characters to really get this idea of, are we supposed to feel bad for these rich people who are attending this park? Or are we supposed to be rooting for them? Like, are we supposed to be rooting for them or against them? And that's kind of the thing, is like, because we spend so much of the movie establishing, oh, these robots are indistinguishable from people, we can never be sure if we're following people or robots. And because of that, it just muddies kind of the way you watch the film, because you're not 100% sure what you're supposed to believe.
Well, and I think it's your perspective. I think that's kind of where this is at, right? Are you somebody who would go to a world like this if this was a theme park that existed? Are you somebody who would go to it, or are you somebody who would avoid it like the plague? Are you somebody who would mock people who go to it, or are you somebody who would run at the first opportunity, right? And I know, obviously, now we are into a world of like, Disney is just blown up to such a gigantic thing that it's beyond what Walt Disney ever thought it was going to be. They own ESPN. They own ABC. They own all this stuff. They own Star Wars. They own all these things that they didn't even create, a lot of it. And now they get the IP to it so they can start to create off of it. And it's put a lot of bad publicity on Disney as they've gobbled up a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But I love going to Disney World. Like, I go all the time. We're not podcasting next week because that's where I'm going to be. I'm not going to be here because I can't podcast because I'm going to be in Disney World. And you get the whole stigma of, oh, you're a Disney adult. You're clogging the lines for people with their families. Disney's like, literally the whole point of Disney was, it's Walt Disney creating a place that is supposed to be for like children.
Everyone. Yeah.
However, there's always going to be people who are just going to hate it, who are either going to hate it for political reasons, who are going to hate it because of the cost of it, who are going to hate the just the entire idea of it. They feel that they feel that it's just they're being taken advantage of for fake fun, for manufactured fun. And I think Westworld is diving into that 2 years after the Magic Kingdom was opened. And it's making you think when you sit there and say, I'm muddied, I don't really know if I like it or don't. I think it's your perspective on these things in general. I think I would go to Westworld. I think that would be awesome. Yep. I think it would be crazy. It's kind of, they just had the, down here in Disney World, they had the Galactic Star Cruiser. It was an absolute disaster. One of the worst decisions ever made by a massive company like that. But that was something that people would try to do at least once because it would feel like you were living the Star Wars world.
Mm-hmm.
Westworld was ahead of its time. This is what people look for entertainment. But in terms of do I like it or not, I do think that comes down to what is John's perspective on it? What is Phil's perspective on it? What is the viewer's perspective?
For sure. And I'm never turning down an amusement park. Amusement parks are great. I love that. And like this type of thing is even better because like acting and just fully immersive. Like it sounds like a ton of fun. I think one of the issues that the movie also has, the characters aren't easily relatable because we know that they're just like these upper class businessmen who are going to this place, right? So instead of what this movie really needed was like a contest winner going to the park or something like that. And it's what Crichton rectifies in Jurassic Park. When you look at the characters in Jurassic Park, you have the scientists who are essentially acting as the doing a what is the word I am looking for?
I lost it.
I know, but they're appraising, they're looking at the park, they're looking at the details of the park and everything. But you also have the children, and the children are the audience surrogate in that film, despite the fact that, you know, some people abhor children. In fact, one of the characters in that movie abhors children.
Mm-hmm.
But they're a surrogate because we can all relate to children in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And that's what this film is really missing, is like an everyman, essentially, for the audience to relate to understand this world better.
Yeah, I think that at the time, the main character probably played a little bit better as that character.
Right.
I think in 1973, this guy who barely has a backstory, played by Richard Benjamin, he barely has a backstory at all. He just he wants to go to the Wild West. They mentioned something about his wife or somebody left her, you know, screw her, who cares? So his buddy's taking him to this place that his buddy's been that he's never been to. It's $1,000 a day, you know, so it's a vacation for the ultra rich. But I do think that this was a character that maybe was more relatable back then, especially to movie going audience, maybe in the early 70s. As opposed to now where we might sit there and say, okay, I wish you could have gotten something else. Also, I do feel like there's the potential that the contest winner thing had been started to be done a little to death. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory came out 2 years before this movie. Yep. And I could see Michael Crichton pushing very hard against wanting to do a movie like that because that was one of the most popular movies in the world at that time. Yeah, and so I could see that being something that they avoided purposefully for that reason.
Yeah. But in that case, like give us a maintenance worker or something mm-hmm. that's a little more connectable. But at the same time, there wasn't, like you said, I think it hits better back then because there wasn't this murkiness between the classes that there is nowadays. So I think like, unfortunately, the world just got way worse than Michael Crichton could have predicted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have one more thing I want to say about this movie, and then I do probably primarily want to talk about Planet of the Apes. But I have to mention a shout out to Steve Franken, the guy who plays the technician that shows up at the end of this movie. For anybody who's a massive fan or even just a small fan of Mystery Science Theater 3000, when they put the ones out on Netflix with Jonah, this guy appears in two of those movies. He appears in The Time Travelers and Avalanche. Two movies that get ripped apart by Mystery Science Theater 3000. Has a pretty decent sized role in both of them. But it cracks me up that he's also in one of the more iconic science fiction movies from that era. So I just want to give a shout out. The Time Travelers was 64. Avalanche was 78. Westworld was right in the middle in 73. And so good for this guy. Just being a little character actor who showed up in a whole bunch of shit. Time Travelers is so bad. Avalanche is so bad. But yeah, it's funny. It was so funny when I saw him. I said, holy crap, that's him. I can't believe it. And it bothered me. I knew his name was Danny. I remember that his name was Danny from the Time Travelers. That's what bothered me the most, to be honest with you.
Well, I don't know what to say. I've actually never watched Mystery Science Theater somehow.
Oh, I feel like you would like that. That's like,
yeah, probably. It seems like something that would be up my alley. Westworld's fun. I think you just have to, like, if you haven't watched the HBO show, I think you would enjoy this film more.
I agree with that. Or, yeah, I mean, the thing is, the first season of Westworld is so good. It has a couple of things I didn't necessarily love, but it's so good. The twist with the man in black with the gunslinger is really well done in the movie or in the show, because you get you have the built-in knowledge of the movie. So they were able to kind of pull the wool over your eyes a little bit easier. But everything after season one is just so bad. It's so bad. I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe you like it. I hated season two so much. I never even bothered putting season three on. I hated the whole Native American storyline in season two. I was like, what are we even talking about? So that's just my opinion. But
yeah, I think season two was still okay for me. Season three is kind of where it lost me.
Yeah. I'll never watch it.
Yeah. I'll never watch that fourth and final season. It was then canceled after.
I didn't even know there was a fourth season. Okay. Yep. All right. That's Westworld. Let's talk about Planet of the Apes. Okay.
Yes.
A little bit earlier than normal. Let's talk Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes coming out this week. Jordan says, I'm cautiously optimistic about Kingdom, but I'm slightly worried. I am in the exact same boat as Jordan. So the Caesar trilogy, which was this trilogy that was, you know, they're not prequels, they're reboots, but they have little hints to the other movies where you're like, could this still fit in that timeline? Whatever. But this reboot trilogy was so well done. First movie sets the world. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which is the one we're going to primarily talk about here, I think is one of the greatest action movies ever made. Mm-hmm. It is so incredibly well directed. The acting, the special effects are absolutely outstanding. I still do not understand how they did the shot with the camera on the tank turret and how they made that all one shot and all the things that are going on in the background. And it looks so flawless with the fact that that is a, you know, motion capture, CGI, ape, whatever. I think it's amazing. And then I think it really closes out with War of the Planet of the Apes very, very well. I think War of the Planet of the Apes is probably the weakest of the trilogy. Let me make sure my Planet of the Apes ranked series here on Letterboxd agrees with that. I don't want to lie to all of you and then say, actually, I have to change my mind now. I have Rise ahead of War. I think the thing with War is they were trying to kind of wrap it up. And sometimes when you try to wrap it up, you can have a couple more plot holes because you're like, okay, we just got to finish this thing out. But that movie looks absolutely amazing too. I didn't know Kingdom was a thing until, you know, a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. And while I'm really excited for it, the concerns I have are Wes Ball directing it, which it's not so much about Wes Ball, even though I've never seen the Maze Runner movies and I don't think I ever will. It's the idea of it's not Matt Reeves. And I know Matt Reeves didn't do Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And trust me, there's a point to this. Don't worry. We're getting there. Rupert Wyatt did Rise, but Matt Reeves did the second and third one. And I think the second and third one were dark. They struck a nice balance, all of that. The other thing is there's no Andy Serkis because Andy Serkis played Caesar. So Andy Serkis is now not in this movie. And finally, the thing that really concerns me the most, recording this at 11 p.m. on a Tuesday night, is they have not released the reviews yet. There's been a lot of trailers out for this movie. There has been a lot of hyping by the studio. And sometimes when they do that for a movie like this, they start to get a little concerned. It starts to maybe look like, I don't know if we're quite going to hit what we need to, because maybe the reviews aren't going to be as good as we hope. So I'm hopeful it will be. But all that being said, a new Planet of the Apes movie, I'm all in on it. And it gives me an excuse to talk about one of the other ones. And that's just what I'm looking for. But why don't you, John, what are your feelings about Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes right now?
We've had this conversation a few times where we're optimists, we're cautiously optimistic, but we're a little concerned about how much promotional material there is. And now the fact that like reviews aren't out yet and the movie comes out this week, I am going to be even more cautiously optimistic about it because I kind of had this realization last week when The Phantom Menace was re-released in theaters and it came second to the domestic box office. People
waiting second in domestic box office
last weekend. Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yes. If you want to hear us talk about The Phantom Menace, head over to the Patreon because that episode dropped today.
It did.
But I actually think studios are trying to get people into theaters, which is why we've seen more of a push for promotional materials for movies lately. And I mean, we've had some bad experience with heavily publicized movies before. This movie wasn't, as much as it like feels like it's really publicized now, it felt like it started a lot later before we started getting a lot of those trailers and everything. You know what? I'll say it. When Rise of the Planet of the Apes came out, I said, why are we making a prequel to...
I said the same thing.
That has one of the greatest twists in cinema history. And I didn't watch it for a couple of years, and then I watched it right before Dawn of the Planet of the Apes came out, and I was like, wow, I was dumb. I should have watched this movie a long time ago. This movie's great. And then Dawn of the Planet of the Apes came out, and I was like, oh, wow, this is good. And even War, I have it as my second in the trilogy after just rewatching it. But again, like I was like a little disappointed in that, but Dawn of the Planet of the Apes was so good that War was never going to live up to it. Mm-hmm. So I'm ready to be blown away by Planet of the Apes. The worst Planet of the Apes is Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes. And there is no way we could get that low again.
No, and we better not get that low again. I mean, here's how I look at it. There's 8 Planet of the Apes movies. Tim Burton's doesn't count. Tim Burton, it's not a Planet of the Apes movie. It's bullshit. It's absolute nonsense. There's no story. There's no reason for it. But when I look at the other 8, the lowest rating I gave any of them is 2.5 stars. Mm-hmm. And so the thing is, what can you do with the storytelling? That's what it comes down to, right? And so that's where I want to focus with Dawn, because I hope that they took from Rise, took from Dawn, took from War, but I hope they took from Dawn the most. Because what Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is being hyped up as, what it's being discussed as, is this movie where apes have now, it's generations past Caesar's death. They're now talking about Caesar's teachings. It seems like they're starting to get a little biblical with this stuff, mm-hmm. where it's getting into the law of ape and all that. Which if you watch the original series, the original 5 movies, they get really into the law of the apes. Like what has been passed down from generation to generation, ape shall not kill ape, all of those things. And how the words are being skewed for the benefit of those who want to get the power or who have the power or whatever it is. And so what I think is so, if that's what they're talking about, humans are now a lesser species. You know, that everything has moved past that. We get Nova in this movie, which I'm a big fan of.
Is it Nova?
I think they're calling her Nova, aren't they?
Because Nova was what the name they gave the kid in War of the Planet of the Apes. Or War for the Planet of the Apes, I should say.
Oh, maybe. Okay, that's what I'm thinking of. Then I knew there was a Nova. Yep. No. Freya Allen is playing Nova/May.
Okay, so they're also making this character Nova, and this is presumably, I think at this point it's very clear Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is probably going to be another trilogy. They're hoping it's another trilogy that will end with a remake of Planet of the Apes.
That is what I am thinking too. That is exactly what I am thinking, because for anybody who's watched the original 5 movies, the first movie is Planet of the Apes. The second movie is essentially a rehash of the first one, but then it goes out into the Forbidden Zone. Mm-hmm. And the concept behind Beneath the Planet of the Apes is absolutely incredible. It is absolutely incredible. The problem is Charlton Heston didn't want to do the movie. And so what happened was they had to retell the entire story with James Franciscus. And because they had to do that, the Charlton Heston part, Charlton Heston does come in at the end of the movie, but he didn't want to be the main character of it. He didn't want to do it again. So they had to rehash it, retell it, and it gets a little sloppy. But the ideas are amazing. Humans who've been living underground, they want to blow up the world. They literally pray to a nuclear warhead. The apes don't go out there because they're too scared of it, all that stuff. And then the third movie is actually set on Earth back in the 1970s. And so it's taking place well, like after the astronaut has taken off. And so the fourth one and the fifth one then follow the storyline through the 70s, 80s, 90s as the apes start to take over. It feels like this movie is the beginning of that. The apes are starting to take over. Mm-hmm. Like we saw the prequel trilogy be the apes are starting from, you know, they get smart, bright eyes, all of that stuff. Caesar can start to talk. We see them taking over. But this feels like it's almost going to be that other side of it where like the apes can't maintain and they start to fall into the ways of humanity in that same kind of struggle. Which will be fascinating to watch how they actually fall apart. And hopefully it just doesn't end with a nuclear warhead going off like Beneath the Planet of the Apes essentially says that's how the Planet of the Apes died out. It seems like they're going to retell that story and actually give it a story that makes sense and is satisfying rather than just, oh, a nuclear warhead, all that. Even though the nuclear warhead shit is awesome. But Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, getting all the way back to that I started 5 minutes ago, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes does such a phenomenal job of building out the ape world and building out the human world and the human struggles and the ape struggles and the parallels between Jason Clark's Malcolm and Caesar and how they're both trying to keep the peace. They're both trying to do its best for their people, but they are surrounded by others who are violent, who are hateful, who are trying to harm, who are causing nothing but problems for them. But they feel loyal to them because they're part of the same species. And right now being part of the same species feels unbelievably important. And so for me, I think if Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes learns from Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, I don't think it'll be as good as Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I think Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is one of those movies that could end up in my top 100. I think it's an absolute masterpiece. But if it can learn from that, of how are we balancing these worlds and where all the apes are and how the apes are growing and how they're starting to deal with the same struggles as humans, how they're trying to figure out what to do with the humans. If it can get into the human storyline at least slightly, this movie could be great because Dawn of the Planet of the Apes laid the groundwork for exactly how you're supposed to make one of these movies. Rise is great. War is great. But Dawn really showed how you can balance the humans and the apes both. Not just make them villains. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, the main villain is Koba, who is an ape. Mm-hmm. That is such a brilliant decision in the writing process. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what that's going to mean for Kingdom, but I think Dawn tells one of the most perfect stories you can of this.
I agree. And a lot of it comes down to the way it's set up. Obviously, like there's a movie that precedes it and everything, but the very opening of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes gives us a newscast explaining to us everything that's happened in the last 10 years. And it's short, it's simple, it's the opening credits. It tells us, you know what? And again, things that were hinted at in Rise of the Planet of the Apes and everything, we get the simian flu, it killed off a bunch of people, and it made the apes smart. That's the entire premise that leads up to this. And we see these apes in the woods of, I mean, my backyard, essentially, because that's where it was filmed. But it's building a society. It shows us a society, and it never gets to the point where it needs to explain anything because it presents it all, right? Yeah. Everything's there. Yes, we have it's a sequel, but everything within the movie that is important to the movie is contained within the movie.
Koba. Yeah, I was just going to say, that's what we always talk about when we talk about movies, right? Like when we talk about the Marvel movies, there's too much information you need to know elsewhere a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And I have to say too, watching that opening is so haunting now because that came out.
It's terrifying now. COVID.
Yeah. Came out 6 years before COVID. And I think that actually makes me even more impressed with this movie of the words and the phrase. I know they're pulling from other you know, real, you know, information half the time. Like the Obama clip is a real clip of Obama telling people to stay inside, I think because of a hurricane or a tornado or something. But, you know, it's the way it's able to pull from all of that stuff. You know, stay inside. There's a quarantine area. You must do this. You must. It's like, this sounds a lot like how COVID sounded 6 years after this movie was made. And I just think that's a really, really awesome thing now when you watch it and see how detailed and how impressively accurate that whole section was.
Yeah, absolutely. It was harrowing. You know, like that's the only word I can really use to describe it. It was harrowing having kind of experienced something like that. Luckily, it didn't kill off the entire population and have apes control the world afterwards. But
yeah,
it's still, it's terrifying. And then at the core of it, and this is the most fascinating thing about this entire trilogy, we're rooting for the apes. The apes are the people that we are, I mean, yes, they're the primary people we're focusing on. Although Dawn does do a very good job of splitting it up between Caesar and the apes and Malcolm and the humans and getting us perspectives on everything and balancing it out. But we are inclined to agree with the apes because what this movie really is this reflection on humanity and what it means to be human. You mentioned that at the top of the podcast, Phil, that the both of these movies we're talking about, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and Westworld, are these focuses on humanity. And the most interesting thing about this entire trilogy is humanity can almost just be summed up as violent and aggressive. Mm-hmm. And that's the main thing that's pushing forward in these films is this idea of aggression and the need to be hostile and face any adversity as bombastically as possible. And that's why Malcolm is such a good character, because he doesn't do that. He's the outlier amongst these humans, just like how Caesar's kind of the outlier amongst the apes because of Koba as his foil and everything. It's just fantastic character building that makes us invested in this film.
Yeah, and I have to say, I feel like the only bad guy in this movie is Kirk Acevedo. The two guys who do like the nonsense with the gun and stuff and make fun of Koba, like that's whatever. But I actually don't find Gary Oldman to be a bad guy in this movie. And that could be like a minor hot take, I don't know. But I feel like Gary Oldman's character is doing whatever it takes to survive and whatever it takes to keep his people alive. We see Woody Harrelson's character in the third movie of this trilogy be a real villain. He's an actual villain. David Oyelowo in the first movie is an actual villain. But in this movie, I don't feel like Gary Oldman is a villain. And I think that's what makes this movie so powerful to me is they found a way to make a war movie where you actually do know both sides well enough to understand what both sides are fighting for and want both sides to accomplish what they want to accomplish. The apes just want their home. The humans just want their home. You have to remember, like, in real life, apes and humans aren't, like, enemies. I know that humans, like, well, you know, in certain areas, poaching and all that stuff. But for the most part, it's like, it's not like you're just like, oh, my God, I hope I don't see an ape today. I'm gonna kill that. Like, that's not how humans and apes think. So it's almost like they want to go back to what their status quo is. It's just now the apes have the knowledge and the understanding of what that means, and they're becoming the dominant species. So how do they handle that? But what we see in this movie is a lot of minor characters not fully understanding what's actually happening because they don't have all the information. And they're making all the poor decisions that ultimately lead to the violence.
Yes.
And it's Kirk Acevedo and Koba. That is it. Those are the only two characters that legitimately want violence. Gary Oldman doesn't want violence in this movie. He just knows that, okay, if they're going to come here, when he blows up the tower at the end, it's not so that he can kill all the apes. It's so that he can save all of humans.
Yeah.
Yes, he's killing apes while doing that, but it is to save the humans, not to just strictly kill the apes. It's like he feels the only way he can save the humans is by killing the apes. And so there is that fascinating back and forth that is going on in this. And again, that just goes back to the power of the screenwriting and the understanding of what the original movies were about. When you watch the first Planet of the Apes, yeah, it's mm-hmm. about Taylor. Look, I got the, let's see, next to my audition. Can you see it over there? Nope. I got my light there. There you go, Planet of the Apes. I can't get it up there. But anyway, there's my Planet of the Apes. You have Taylor sitting there, and he's your main character. But by the time he gets to the ape world, we also know Zira and Cornelius and Zaius unbelievably well, too. And Zaius is an ass. We know that. Zaius is the pompous, religious. He wants to follow the word of ape. Like, that's it. You know, the only good human is a dead human. You know, that's the mentality, even though that line's actually from the second movie. And it's spoken by one of the guerrilla war generals. But it's like, when you see that, the understanding of that first movie is it's not just about the humans. It's about the apes who are also trying to do good. The scientists, the ones who are trying to move the needle forward. And that's what this movie balances so well.
Yeah.
And the only pure villain is Koba. But of course, Koba is a pure villain because he's the one who is the test dummy. He's the subject. He's the one who's being cut open in the first movie. And so I think the understanding of him hating humans makes his heel turn make so much sense.
Oh, and that's the very interesting thing and why he works so well as a foil to Caesar, because Caesar's the exact opposite, right? Caesar was coddled, had a fantastic relationship with humans, with an actual human where he had a relationship, and Cope, it's this idea of just losing all of my thoughts today. Nature versus nurture, right? Where we see the nature of apes. What's the nature of apes? The nature of apes is that they want to work together. They want to be a collective together. They want to isolate themselves away from humans and just get away from it all. But the nurture of it is Caesar is more welcoming of humans because of the way he was raised. And Koba is resentful towards them because he was tortured and experimented on. Yeah. And that's, again, how this film balances it so well, because Koba and Caesar are two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's what makes these characters so compelling. When Koba becomes the villain, and granted, it's telegraphed throughout the entire movie, but it does kind of catch you a little off guard when you find out how aggressive he wants to get in this instance.
Mm-hmm.
It only works because up until that point, you're seeing the two of them work in tandem together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Koba and Caesar in the first movie, I mean, like, Caesar getting with Koba is one of the big moments of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And in this one, you see Koba, the anger and the hate coming out of him. I mean, he sees Kirk Acevedo, not that he sees it happen, but Kirk Acevedo shoots Ash.
Mm-hmm.
And Koba can't stand that Caesar doesn't want to have a bigger reaction to it. And what does Koba do later in the movie? Kills Ash. He's the one who does it. And that's great. And I have to say this because truly, this is just where Matt Reeves, the director of this movie, just gets filmmaking and where it's so impressive. The scene where Koba shoots Caesar,
yes,
is straight out of Platoon. I think I said that probably whenever I watched this, when we were watching whatever, we'd always say, what's the best movie you watched this week? And I probably said this at one point. But that scene is straight out of Platoon. If you have not seen Platoon, I will not spoil it. But that scene is straight out of Platoon. And the brilliance of pulling that off with two apes.
Mm-hmm.
In a movie that's essentially a war movie, very similar to the type of war movie that, you know, Platoon obviously is Vietnam and all that, but like in the same type of thing of, we don't necessarily trust those who are in power. Why are we stuck doing this? To the fact that he pulled that off, go watch Platoon. You'll know exactly what scene I'm talking about. Like I said, I want to spoil Platoon. But go watch it and you'll see it and you'll turn around and you'll go watch this and you'll say, oh my God, Matt Reeves took that directly off of Oliver Stone's movie. And sometimes, you know, the biggest form of flattery is imitation or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
it's brilliant. It's so brilliant. And I'm just so appreciative of the fact that you get like that capable of a director directing Planet of the Apes movies all these years later. Cause I mean, Franklin P. Schaefer, who directed the original one, like, it's not like he is like the biggest name, you know? I mean, if you asked anybody to name, can you name another one of his movies?
No.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think we're also at a point now where we have to just acknowledge Matt Reeves is one of the best action directors out there.
Yeah.
Like, his record stands for itself, right? I mean, he has two Planet of the Apes movies that were both very well received. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, when Upon Us was released, was heralded as the best movie sequel ever made.
Yeah. And I have to say, by the way, Franklin J. Schaffner, Planet of the Apes, Patton and Papillon. So he has made some good movies. It's okay. Just a matter of he's not the type of household name. But yeah, this is a phenomenal sequel. It's phenomenal. Yeah. And personally, I think it could be. I mean, it's not The Godfather Part Two.
No.
But it is. It's a phenomenal sequel. And it is such – the first movie's great, but it is such an improvement in so many technical elements. It is what I think really sets it apart. And it doesn't go with the technical elements at the sake of foregoing the the story. The story stays fantastic the entire time. Mm-hmm. So
and that is a very important part. Like the CGI, it's CGI from a decade ago. Honestly, still looks decent, but there are times where you're like, that's very like animated. But at the performances that go into all this motion capture in this film. And everyone raves about Andy Serkis in these movies, and rightfully so. He is phenomenal as Caesar. But Toby Kebbell is as Koba. Even like Nick Thurston is Blue Eyes. Judy Greer is Cornelia. Mm-hmm. Terry Notary is Rocket. Like, they're so... Karen Carnival is Maurice. Like,
yeah, that's the best. That's the best character in the movie.
The scene where Maurice sits down with Cody Smith McPhee's character and they're just going over the book together is just this really heartwarming moment about why is there so much animosity between these two species.
Mm-hmm.
And like that's the type of scene in a movie that makes you look at the real world and wonder why do we all hate each other so much?
Yeah. I know it's kind of depressing. It is. It's really, really depressing. I love that the characters that they built in this movie, and I love how naturally they built them. I love how naturally they built Caesar's army, Caesar's loyal people. I love how they have the enemies who are very naturally the enemies. I really appreciate all of that in these movies. And I just hope Kingdom can pull those kinds of things off. Because from a technical standpoint, I have no doubt that they can make a great movie. There's no question about it. They can make a great movie. But I hope that they can pull off the story and the characters and all of that in the same way that this movie was able to. Because this movie really is, like, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is just breathtaking filmmaking. And, you know, Rise of the Planet of the Apes caught everybody by surprise. It wasn't super hyped up when it was coming out. Like I said, I've been a Planet of the Apes fan since the day I was born, essentially. It wasn't super hyped up when it came out. People weren't really sure what to expect, and it was the surprise hit of the summer. And then they were able to go and make Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And when that came out, it was like, oh my God, look what you can do. And what's funny is, like, sometimes you can feel a little silly, right? You watch a movie like Avatar, and you can feel a little silly that there's blue people running around. And a movie like this, you feel a little silly that you're watching a bunch of apes, like, do whatever. But the character building is just so phenomenally well done that you feel like you are watching humans. Because at the end of the day, like we said, what makes a sentient being? You are watching humans. You are watching humans just with a lot more hair walk around and make decisions and go through the struggles and deal with power struggles and different complexes and things like that. Yeah. It's legit. So, if you haven't seen Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and somebody just listened to this, I don't know what just happened, but it's just a really good movie. I mean, I think that's the best way to say it. It's just a really, really, really good movie.
Yeah. And you know what? There's elements of this movie we haven't even talked about. Michael Giacchino's score in this film is phenomenal.
That's your go-to word, man. You love talking about Giacchino scores.
I haven't talked about a Giacchino score. When was the last time Giacchino?
I don't know, man. I'm just messing with you.
But all honesty, like, there are callbacks to things like Ligeti, and on top of that, you just have this. I don't want to use the word primal, but I guess it is primal, right? Like, there's this primal drive to a lot of this score that heats up in these moments of aggression, but there's also these calms that feel so tranquil throughout, and it just perfectly pairs with the film.
Mm-hmm. No, the score is great. And Giacchino, anything he touches, we've definitely talked about the Lost score on this podcast before, John.
I would imagine so.
Up? I know when we watched Up, we talked about
it. Oh, yeah, probably.
So yeah, Michael Giacchino, like, whenever he touches something, it's normally great. And yeah, the score to this is great. The visuals are great. I don't have a complaint about this movie. I really don't. And I think that I know that Kingdom's not going to be this good. I'm just really hoping that Kingdom doesn't ruin what is a perfect trilogy here, because it is a perfect trilogy. And it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's a better trilogy than the first five movies for sure. Cause the first five movies, a lot of it is cheap ball. But, you know, Planet of the Apes, the original, is still my favorite one. It's not even close. But I just think when it comes to this, like, these are the types of apocalyptic movies I want to be watching. Right. And who would have thought that Planet of the Apes is what would be able to pull these things off so incredibly well.
Yeah.
So, do you have anything else you want to say about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes?
We say this almost all the time when we talk about these movies. This is one you have to revisit because it's so good. Phil might actually put it in the top 100. You've given it 4.5 stars the last two times you've watched this movie. I'm surprised it still isn't in your top 100.
Well, because I haven't redone my top 100.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm redoing my top 100 after I hit 1,000 movies on Letterboxd. So I want to do 1,000 reviews on Letterboxd. And right now, I'm clicking my stats because this is probably going to happen. This will probably happen over the summer, to be completely honest with you. Right now I'm at 918. So I have 82 more movies and then I will do it. So once I hit 82 more movies, and I think I'm going to do every, like, you know, 200 movies I watch or something like that, I'll just put out a new top 100. I don't care. But yeah, I'm not going to do like every 5 years. Like, I haven't done one now since 2020. I'm not going to be doing that, but that's just where I'm at with this. But anyway, yeah, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is great. Westworld's great. Westworld's not as good as Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, but it's a fun, old school 1970s sci-fi. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're off next week because I am going to be on vacation. Like I said, the week after, we're going to be doing Rocket Man and I'm Not There, which is going to coincide with the release of... oh my God.
Back in Black.
Yes. Yes.
The Amy Winehouse movie.
Which is the Amy Winehouse one. So we'll be talking about those two movies, which are about Bob Dylan and Elton John. So that should be a good time. And if you want to become a patron, patreon.com/thespecialist. We just put out our Phantom Menace review today. I panned it. It was so much fun to talk about, though. It might be one of the most fun podcasts I've ever done. And then we also have Being John Malkovich coming out next Tuesday. Then this is Spinal Tap. And then Chungking Express is what's rounding out May for us. So consider becoming a patron. Thank you all so much for listening. Like the video, subscribe to the channel, and we will see you in 2 weeks.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
I earned my degree online at Arizona State University. I chose to get my degree at ASU because I knew that I'd get a quality education, they were recognized for excellence, and that I would be prepared for the workforce upon graduating. To be associated with ASU, both as a student and alum, it makes me extremely proud, and having experienced the program, I know now that I'm set up for success. Learn more at asuonline.asu.edu.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,